Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hide up on gallows tree, swing the noble hearted tree, fight the vengeful tyrants stricken in their blue. But they met them face to face with the courage of their race, and they went with swords and daunted to their doom. God save Ireland, says the heroes. God save Ireland, says the all. Whether on the scaffold high or the battlefield we die, no matter when for Ireland dear we fall.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. Joe is Joe's laughing. He wants me to ask him a very quick question. How are you, Joe Brawley? Who are you, Joe Brawley?
I gave up trying to answer that question a long time ago.
You were just upset that I spoke for too long on Tuesday. You've been all at me about
at
it.
All.
You're like, God, you've got to just stop speaking. It's like when you call me up and tell me you're getting better at listening. You often call me and say, I'm cracking this listening thing. It's like, yeah. Actually, when we recorded, most of the time we record together. We were recording remotely a while ago on just one episode, and I had real problems hearing you. And I actually realized this must be how Joe feels all the time. I just can't hear the other person speak at all. So I'll just say my own points.
It was like the time Marion Finucane was interviewing me on RT Radio, and I could hear her eating crisps. She was just completely absentmindedly. She had just completely switched off as I was rambling on. I could actually hear her eating crisps.
Look, we're going to talk about the future and some of the stuff you raised on Tuesday's episode about Gareth Fitzgerald and what relevance. I personally don't think it has much relevance to what
it is
his
to
son,
the IIEA.
John Fitzgerald.
It does. I maintain on the basis of, forensic analysis of the IIEA, that it is essentially a propagandistic think tank for Fine Gael, and that the question you have to ask yourself about a report like the IIEA's, which came out with a big banner headline, 20 billion a year, bearing in mind 4 years ago it was 30 billion a year, right? Who benefits from that? Who benefits from that?
Isn't the idea that we actually have a conversation about these things?
Yes, but if it's honest, that report was 3,000 words, right? And there was a couple of headlines in it, and I told you what my pal from KPMG said, economics is only useful as a form of employment for economists, particularly dickheads like Fitzgerald. No, it's not very, But if you look at all of the other reports, let's start with Professor Fitzgerald. Professor Fitzgerald was a leading figure. He was described as a top economist in the years leading up to the financial collapse when Ireland went bankrupt. And he loudly proclaimed, because he was brought out by the establishment parties as their guy, he was the top economist. And if they say he's the top economist, economist and the newspapers describe him as the top economist, then he's the top economist. I mean, who's any the wiser? He loudly proclaimed, "The banking system and economy of Ireland are on a very sound footing." And 2 months later, they collapsed. And he was their poster boy. He was Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil's poster boy. And again, I took the liberty before we started the podcast to look at his evidence to the Oireachtas Banking Inquiry afterwards. And he was pressed about these very confident predictions that the banking system and the Irish financial system were in a very sound footing, and the economy was in a very sound footing. Nothing to worry about here. Two months later, it all collapsed. Right? This is the guy, the Fine Gael guy, who's fear mongering now about Irish unification.
Well, look,
and he said, let me just say what he said, all right? Because it's important. It's important to know what a person's track record is if you're talking about him as a top economist. He said, "I must confess now, I fail to foresee the financial collapse." Whoopie-doo. "We made the call and we were totally wrong." He accepted that it was, quote, "a big mistake." Is that really the most sort of, you know, is that really the most appropriate word in the circumstances? Big. The destruction of so many lives, the destruction of so many people's savings, their pensions destroyed. He said, "Yes, I confess we did not spot these difficulties. They were obvious difficulties." Yes, they were obvious difficulties on the balance sheets of Irish banks at the time. "Why did you not spot those?" He said, "Well, not seeing the unsound," this is quote, "not seeing the unsound nature of the banking sector was, I admit, a bad mistake. And I will regret that until the day I die. Not as much as the people who lost everything."
Somebody speaking honestly about the mistakes they've made, and everyone in every walk of life.
What was he going to do? They showed him a video of what he had said. What was he going to do? This was a court.
Okay. Anyway, the point I would make about that, I think it's fair enough to look at a guy's record when he's actually making a statement about United Ireland or bringing out figures, and they've been disputed. And you can say, well, look, let's look at his track record. Let's see what he's got wrong. Let's see what he's predicted in the past. And that's all legitimate. I think it's slightly, I think when you go and start talking about his, you know, Gareth Fitzgerald and linking that to him, it's a way of actually disqualifying people because from a debate, which
not necessarily,
because like this is the thing, everyone is going to be part of this conversation. Whether like we had a podcast a few weeks ago where you were rightly angry about the idea that talking about a united Ireland was unhelpful. This thing that was being put out, it's unhelpful to talk about it. It's unhelpful to say this. And you were right to say, why is it unhelpful? Why isn't, you know, you were completely right then. But so it's equally, you can't say to people who are talking about it, "I don't like the way you're talking about it. So now I'm going to tell you that actually, because of the way your father," like if we're going to disqualify from the conversation everybody who despised the IRA, then it's going to be quite a small conversation about a united Ireland. You give out about people IRAing. You're coming along and Fine Gaeling about what things that happened in 1981.
Yeah, if you're, I mean, one of the favourite things we saw with Simon Harris at his inaugural speech to the Fine Gael faithful is to talk about the IRA and get a cheer. You know, it's a cheap cheer. It's a DUP thing. So no matter what pragmatic or rational argument is made, you say, but the IRA, you know, and I mean, you're these horrific people, the IRA. So I call it IRA and I make no apology for it. It's different. This is an economist. So we look at his credentials. We look at his track record. We look at his background. We forensically scrutinize his report. I'm going to come to all of that. Don't worry about it. But his background is Fine Gael royalty. We know what his dad was. All these things would be relevant in a court of law, for example, if you were going to explore his credentials, his potential motivation. And in my view, he's a hitman for Fine Gael. That's what he's used for. He was used.
But his grandfather was in 19 was part of 1916. Is that not his Spiegel credential?
Let's go through the evidence, and then you can go back and make those points. Der Spiegel, okay, one of the leading German intellectual magazines. It had a damning critique just a few weeks ago about Ireland's housing crisis, Ireland's rental time bomb. And they gave numerous examples of, €2,000 for a one-room apartment, how the vulture funds had taken over the sector, how the Irish government, successive Irish governments had let this run out of control. They described a property rental market spiraling out of control. And they talked about the consulting firm Deloitte & Touche, who recently named Dublin's rental market as the most expensive in Europe. The middle class has long been threatened by this. Thousands of families are now homeless. The number of emigration, which has always been an indicator of problems in any country, has recently increased significantly. Okay, it's got one of the biggest circulations of any news magazines in Europe. And as you know, a proud tradition of investigative journalism. And it talked about how Ireland has reached a new record with more homeless families than at the time of the Great Famine in the 19th century. And who did Fine Gael, who came out to attack? Top economist John Fitzgerald has blasted German criticism of Irish housing crisis and says it comes from jealousy of our economy. This is a quote. Top economist John Fitzgerald said that this was fake news.
He didn't say Donald Trump. Did he?
He described it as, quote, fake news. Check it out. Germany is obviously jealous of the fact that the Irish economy is very successful in contrast to Germany, where they are seeing low growth. Ireland's challenges, he said, are problems of success, and here we go. The Irish economy, he said, has grown very rapidly in recent years, with the result that a load of skilled people are finding it difficult to secure rental properties. A load of skilled people, with home ownership also extremely challenging. So,
well, it's a...
Ireland's economy, hold on. Ireland's economy is in a better footing than Germany's, all right, which is the third biggest economy in the world. And their housing and rental problems, which are, it's a dream. It's a dream out there to rent or to try and buy a house because governments have made sure that that's affordable for all of their citizens. But Rory Hearn, right, who's written books about this and who I believe to be a person of good intent, and has a genuine interest in Irish people. He was featured in the Der Spiegel piece, but what his response to what top economist John Fitzgerald had said was, I completely disagree. The Irish housing crisis is down to Ireland's economic success. Even before the Irish economy took off again in 2015, I was highlighting a new housing crisis in 2014. This Fine Gael-led government has decided to grow our economy with foreign investment funds without making any plans for housing, or for our people. Living standards in Germany are almost 50% higher than in Ireland, and that's based on European Union figures.
Mm.
So I asked myself, well, why is he so hysterically defending the status quo here? And why? Why was the IIEA report, and it's not a report, 3,000 words. Generally, the typical length of a Sunday column of mine is 1,200 words. It's like, that's what you're talking about here. But, yeah. Who benefits? So we saw what happened in the North with the Good Friday Agreement, the euphoria around that. It swept the SDLP away. Sinn Féin, as was always going to happen, had captured the public imagination around it. And we saw that tidal wave, which has led now to their dominance in the North. Okay. And we see that same process building in the South now. And what Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are terrified of more than anything else is a united Ireland. Because Sinn Féin will be the owners of that. In effect, they're the only national party. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil would have to be doing deals with parties in the North. They've never worked out in the past. Right. So the fear is an existential fear. If we gallop towards a united Ireland, if we seriously plan for a united Ireland, as we are obliged to do under the Constitution, Article 3.1, which we discussed on Tuesday, who are going to be the main beneficiaries of this? And the main beneficiaries of this, without any doubt, are going to be Sinn Féin, because they have doggedly stayed with united Ireland, united Ireland, united Ireland. All the glamour of that, all the euphoria of a referendum that says yes to a United Ireland. You can just imagine. I mean, Fianna Fáil would be done. I mean, because they're the sort of the Southern SDLP. Fine Gael would occupy that you know, they would have a narrower electorate, because as the wealthy side of the electorate shrinks and shrinks, so that you see now this week, for example, there are now 1,600 individuals in the South who are worth more than 20 million. You know, that's an increase of 200 in just 12 months. So although they can't say it, they can't say that they're opposed to a United Ireland, what they can do is fearmonger. And what better way than to use top economist?
Well,
they're slow peddling. I mean, and there's massive frustration. People have good intent. The Ireland's Future people, for example, are trying to get engagement from the government. They simply can't get it. We heard Simon Harris last week, it's not a priority.
Well, there's a couple of things you say there that I don't, like. You say we're galloping, we should be galloping towards a United Ireland. Like whatever way it's going to happen, the one thing this report kind of makes clear is that, you know, it's still going to be a long process. It's still going to be a long process. Have you ever heard of a guy, there are good reasons why it should be a long process. Have you ever heard of a guy called Richard North? No.
No.
Richard North was one of the foremost advocates for Brexit. He was one of the deepest thinkers in the kind of Brexit movement. And he felt, you know, Britain was much better outside the EU. He was one of those people who had a kind of legitimate belief in just Britain being independent of the EU. But his view was that it would take many, many years for Britain to have to do this. They couldn't come along in one day and have a vote and leave the next day, or even within 1 year or 2 years. It would take 20 years of negotiations to get into a situation like that. And he was part of the movement, and then something he put, this is what he said, something then happened. I don't know what. Dominic Cummings went dark on me, and I was no platformed. And basically what happened was they were creating a movement of three-word slogans: take back control, give ourselves freedom now, all this kind of stuff for Brexit. And they didn't want somebody who was coming along talking about the boring procedures of negotiations and, you know, Norwegian style relationships with the EU. And he was put into the, just hidden away, and nobody wanted to hear from him. And one of the many disasters about Brexit is because, you know, that stuff wasn't planned for, right? Everybody who understands about a United Ireland knows we have to plan for this. We can't just we have to have conversations about it. And when you say
Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil don't want to
Micheál Martin has his Shared Island initiative, which people speak very highly of. But what I will say as well, Joe, is when you say that Sinn Féin will reap the benefit of this, by the time we come to United Ireland, Sinn Féin will, although they're slipping in the polls and the next, you know, the way they've handled various issues, including the hate speech bill, immigration, has been kind of, even if you are a Sinn Féin supporter, you must be looking at it going, hold on a second, this is, they're jumping around from one place to another on this. But what I'm going to say is, by the time United Ireland comes along, Sinn Féin will probably have been in government. They will have already lost some of that sheen. And the other thing I'd say about what you said is, if United Ireland is to work, it can't be a Sinn Féin project. It has to be something else.
I didn't say that it was.
No, you said it would be.
I said that politically, they would be the ones who would benefit most from it. Because don't forget, they're already dominant in the North. So if you're uniting, you're already bringing in a
the biggest party
in the North, you know, and with all of the attractions and the pragmatic benefits that brings with it as well. Micheál Tomlinson, I say that on the basis of forensic analysis of the very many scholarly pieces of research that are out there, some of them running to a lot more than 3,000 words, that the document is a fallacy in the IAEA document, and it's been used to scaremonger. I mean, we saw, for example, Matt Cooper, another great friend of Northern people, saying that it was going to cost $400 billion over 20 years. But Michael Tomlinson, who's the Emeritus Professor of Social Policy at Queen's University, writing about the report, said this assumption that the North is a costly basket case economy requiring a high level of subvention from the British Treasury is built into political narratives in the South. The idea the subvention will cost $10 billion has already been roundly debunked and, quite frankly, he said, is a myth. Professor John Doyle, who's the head of DCU School of Law, Government and Research, in a very detailed paper in 2021, among other academics, entitled Why the Subvention Does Not Matter, wrote, the figure of $10 billion, frequently quoted as representing the UK government annual subvention to Northern Ireland, is, and this is precisely what my pal in KPMG told me, a UK accounting exercise. It is not real. The total includes central UK government costs allocated to Northern Ireland as an accountancy exercise that will not be relevant to any United Ireland. And he then assessed all of the significant elements of what's called the subvention. Okay, pensions, UK national debt repayments, defence expenditure, and other non-identified expenditure. Okay. Now, he concluded on the basis of extensive research, it's all set out, you can go through it, you know, in fine detail, that the elements of the current subvention likely to transfer to United Ireland would represent approximately 2.8 billion euro. Not 20 billion euro, 2.8 million. All existing economic models of an all-Ireland economy predict a positive impact on economic growth at a level sufficient to cover this deficit, right, the 2.8 billion. The economic debate on Irish unity urgently needs to move on from a discussion of the subvention, which is a distraction often used for political means. The debate must focus on the public policy decisions necessary to support sustainable economic growth and to maximise the benefits a larger and integrated all-Ireland economy will undoubtedly bring. Okay. The Northern Ireland subvention is, in essence, the public sector deficit for Northern Ireland as calculated by the UK Office for National Statistics and is an accounting exercise for the UK state. Okay. The Office for National Statistics, okay, regards these figures. Now, you just compare this to the IIEA report, regards these figures as, quote, experimental statistics. The cost of pensions will not transfer to United Ireland. This is part of. So the second thing then, UK public debt. Now, here's something again that's not mentioned in the IIEA report. Northern Ireland has not made any contribution to UK debt repayment since the 1950s and has not been expected to since then. In practice, an amount of debt repayment expenditure, this is included in the IIEA submission, is allocated to the North, okay, as an accountancy exercise. The cost is actually covered by the UK Treasury. Therefore, there will be no additional cost to the UK compared to what they've been paying over many years. Now, the third element is defence. You know what that covers? That's an amount of 1.139 billion per annum, right? And it's allocated to Northern Ireland, again, as an accountancy exercise, as its share of UK-wide defence expenditure, okay? Now, this has nothing to do with, you know, ordinary security costs, the police, the courts, the prisons. Right, they're identified separately and they're finite sums. Only a tiny, this is, I'm reading directly from the report. As can be seen, only a tiny proportion of this expenditure takes place in Northern Ireland and includes, for example, a pro rata contribution to the UK's nuclear weapons programme and the UK's international commitments in Iraq, Afghanistan and other places. All right? Okay, and the crucial paragraph is this, and this is agreed by economists everywhere. I'm going to come on to other reports. Those elements of the current subvention that are likely to transfer to United Ireland, converted to euros at today's rates, will represent a deficit, therefore, of approximately 2.8 billion euro. Okay, and the future state could cope with that easily on a transitional basis, because of course, and it's in the top economist John Fitzgerald's report, They assume that Northern Ireland's economy will remain stagnant and that nothing will change. okay? But as all of the other reports agree, the most important issue for future public finances of United Ireland is not the subvention at all, okay, which is a red herring, but rather the performance of the All-Ireland economy and the public policy decisions taken by the new state, okay? While some work has been carried out on the benefits of a fully integrated All-Ireland economy, the academic research and public debate on what policy would be adopted by a new Irish state has hardly begun. And the IIEA report, right, in my view, is an attempt to stymie that and to fearmonger, because it doesn't discuss at all the likely economic benefits of a fully integrated economy.
But isn't that, but it also, in fairness to them, and I agree with you about that, like when Ireland got independence in 1921, I don't think any of the debt was carried over. The Irish Free State at that stage didn't take any debt on board. So that is something you would actually expect. Although there was an argument said that, you know, Britain in this case would be worried about what would happen with Scotland and all that kind of thing. But when you talk about productivity, there definitely, you can say right, foreign direct investment, all these things coming in, they would definitely revitalize the North. But at the same time, there are other things.
We're empty in the north. See, Dublin's a car park. I mean, Belfast's empty.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the biggest developers in Europe, in their annual report, said that Belfast is positioned to become the Hong Kong of Europe. In the event of unification.
Look, you know, we've talked about this
for very obvious reasons.
Like we talked about this. I was in Antrim over the Easter weekend, and we went into Belfast, we went to Giant's Causeway, we went all over, and you know, there's so much to do there. But also, you are struck still by, even in terms of tourism, there's certain places you go. It's far behind. It's so far behind because it's had 30 years when people didn't want to go there. You know what I mean?
And there's no joined up thinking. So the two tourist boards are separate.
No, they're not. There's a tourism. Tourism is 32 counties.
No, the Northern Ireland Tourist Board and the Irish Tourist Board are separate.
Well, there's a 32 county element.
I know the chief executive of the Northern Ireland Tourist Board. They're completely separate. But the point being that there's no joined up thinking. So one of the big flaws, in fact, well, I mean, apart from the fact that of the flaws that have already been identified in the IIEA's report, is that they ignore the positive effects of an All Ireland integration. And I don't know if you're aware of Dr. Kurt Hubner's research, which I'll come back to, but he and his team, and I'll go through their credentials in a moment, they said that it will mean tens of billions of added wealth for the newly unified country over the first few years. And the benefits of Irish unity, which are predicted to break 2-1 in the Norse fever, will see the equivalent of an economic adrenaline shot administered with immediate positive effects in terms of productivity, investments, jobs, and tax receipts. See, apart from everything else, Dion, the political situation in the North hasn't been able to be relied on. You know, throughout the whole period of the last 50 years. I mean, because, you know, people are not prepared to invest there, not in the way that they're prepared to invest in the South. But the problem with the report, and the reason that I rubbish it and say that it would not stand up and that he would not come into court and try to stand over that, for example, in a forensic environment, is that no account is taken of the wider economic effects of Irish unification, which is an extraordinary omission. And in his report, he admits that.
You know, I think we should get him into, whatever about getting into court, I think we should have him on this podcast, because I think that would be a conversation people
I would like
to
ask him why his dad put the hunger strikers families out of a meeting just a few weeks before Thomas McElwee died, you know, and Thomas's two sisters. That's what I would like to ask him. And did he ever speak to his dad about that? What was his... You know, privately, was his dad, did his dad ever regret the way he treated us, you know?
Well, that would be an interesting conversation to have. Let me just say about what you're talking about. I think everyone agrees that most people really agree now that if you could get a united Ireland, or everyone sees the potential benefits in having a united Ireland. And the, that report doesn't mention those things, but also it doesn't mention either that there is an elephant in the room, if you like, and that, you know, we're anticipating great foreign direct investment and great boost on the basis that all of this is done in a peaceful and harmonious way. So one of the things that is necessary to ensure that we have a united Ireland that people are going to invest in is a unionist community who are going to be part of that Ireland, who are happy with how that is done. Otherwise, you could have a far more calamitous situation, which isn't going to be attractive to foreign direct investment, is going to lead to greater costs, is going to lead to a depression in the economy if you have those kind of things. So one of the interesting things I think about what this report gets you thinking about is, A, that Northern Ireland as it stands, the more productive it can become, the better it is from the point of view of where it will be if and when Ireland is united. And B, that the conversations we need to be having are still with unionist people to make it everybody understand that there is a huge benefit to be had from United Ireland, but everybody needs to be, or as many people as possible need to agree to that.
If you think for one second that this report was designed to facilitate, you know, bringing unionism on board and moving towards a positive outcome, you are absolutely.
I didn't. That's not what I said.
What has happened? Sorry. Yes, that it would facilitate discussion and we'd start to bring unionist people along and lessen their fears about the end of it. Like, I mean, what absolute nonsense!
No, I didn't
every
say that. I said,
unionist,
well,
every single unionist politician in the North, including the Jamie Brysons, have now said, well, there you are. We told you it's a pipe dream, so you can't afford it.
No, what I said was that it would
destroy Ireland. Well, that's what they're saying. And they knew that that's what they were going to say.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Let me come back to Dr. Kurt Hubner and his team's report, Modelling Irish Unification 2015. Very substantial report, not 3,000 words, it's 100 pages. And Kurt Hubner, as you know, is a professor at the Political Science Department at the University of British Columbia, the Jean Monnet Chair for European Integration and Global Political Economy, the Director of the Institute of European Studies. He has published 12 books, numerous articles and journals. His most recent books, Europe, Canada, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, Global Currency Competition and Cooperation, and his expertise is in the area of European integration in the context of the global political economy. Okay, and he's particularly interested in the political economy of Germany. Then there's Dr. Renger van Neufkoop, Professor Stephen Raphael, who's a professor of public policy at the University of California in Berkeley. These people have no axe to grind one way or the other. Marcus Nolan, the Executive Vice President and Director of Studies with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. This is what they concluded in their report. The modelling of Irish unification suggests an overall positive and strong net benefits that are likely to be even larger if the process of economic and political unification is accompanied by the right economic policy decisions. Okay. Our modelling exercise points to strong positive unification effects driven by successful currency devaluation and a policy-dependent industrial turnaround. Okay.
But that's what assumptions are they making as part of their?
Well, they're just looking, you know, at every possible aspect. You know, again, they dismiss the subvention. They dismiss the subvention as simply something that's not of relevance. You know, and particularly this idea, which has been hawked around for a good while now by the IAEA, that you're talking about 30 billion 4 years ago, now 20 billion a year. They dismiss that entirely. I mean, Professor Seamus McGuinness at the ESRI, he said about he calls it a note, John Fitzgerald's note. It ignores fundamental facts. It is entirely unrealistic in terms of the way constitutional change would unfold. And this mini industry of estimating subvention, which seems to assume it is a constant that will apply immediately following a border poll, really makes no sense whatsoever in terms of reality.
That's fine. Look, that's
let me finish. This is we're talking. You may not like it, but this is what we're talking about. He said the IIEA analysis ignores, quote, fundamental facts. Okay. I mean, I invite our listeners to read Modelling Irish Unification 2015, which is a massive piece of work, which was commissioned by a non-profit organisation. And, you know, the personalities in that appear to be above and beyond reproach, have no political allegiances, you know. And, I mean, I think that it is a deliberate attempt, and it's been jumped on by the establishment in the South to fearmonger.
Well, there's been a lot of conversation on the back foot, an awful lot of it saying how exaggerated the figure has been.
The first rule of propaganda, and I remember an SAS colonel on the BBC, an ex-SAS, talking about the first rule of propaganda. And he said, the first thing that people hear, whether it's true or not, as long as you get it out there, it's going to be very difficult for them to get that out of their minds.
But it does.
What this report has done is put a fundamentally false number into people's heads.
Do you think people wouldn't vote for United Ireland if they felt that was that was going to be the cause?
You look, for example, twinned with that, I think you see this far right, okay? And we see in Ireland that what's happening is that they're protesting outside the Sinn Féin offices, okay? Not outside the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil offices, but outside the Sinn Féin offices. And, you know, where is that coming from? You know, where is the impetus for them to do that coming from? You know, we see them, for example, making allegiances with the far right in the UK. You know, Nigel Farage is a hero of theirs. Who benefits from all of this? You know, and is it a coincidence that over the last few months now, Sinn Féin have started to reduce in the polls from the position that they were in? And, you know, I see parallels with the attack on Jeremy Corbyn's radical project in the UK, where a thoroughly good man who was talking about things like eradicating homelessness on my first day, you know, building vast amounts of council houses, going back to doing what we were doing, make sure that every Briton has a home that he can afford. A man who had no self-interest in this, who wasn't feathering his own nest, was destroyed by a right-wing project that had the media in harness, you know, because it was going to threaten wealth, it was going to threaten the oligarchs, and it was going to threaten the establishment, you know. And I think that no tactic will be dirty enough over the next while.
I would say
to try to, 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 I'm surprised. I mean, like, for example, you take somebody like Rory Hearn, who I greatly admire, who has evangelized on the housing crisis. And, you know, I just think is a genuine, terrific fellow who's genuinely interested in the plight of a lot of his fellow Irish people and human beings in general. If he were in a position of strength, let's say he were, you know, the leader of Sinn Féin, well, they would be going after him in exactly the same way the right wing went after Jeremy Corbyn. You know, they would dwell on the minutiae. They would spread sort of hateful propaganda about him. You know, and it's very, very dispiriting to see this, like in Ballina at the weekend. Amazingly, in Ballina, you know, an area that's benefited from emigration all over the world. You know, people from this beautiful area of Ballina have benefited from emigration all over the world. But at the weekend, there was a small but vocal protest of locals about a hotel here that's going to be used as a direct provision centre. You know, and you despair that this is happening.
Well, you see, I agree with you.
By darker forces.
But I would say that the reason that there's people from the far right outside Sinn Féin offices is because Sinn Féin, in all polls, their voters have stronger anti-immigration views than any other party. That's why...
Who was with the protesters. I'll tell you who was with the protesters in Ballinan, who said that he was there to express his concerns as well about what was happening. Dara Cailleary, the local TD.
Oh, look, so there's no question.
Explain that one.
Well, no, I'm not going to explain that one because there's been plenty. There's been councillors. There's been some horrible stuff said by councillors from parties about it. But I'm talking about voters, and that's probably why Sinn Féin are suffering in the polls as well. In an ideal world,
we would have a radical. We would have a radical solution to the problems, which means the Sinn Féin government at the next election in an ideal world in the South, because, you know, the primary duty of government is to provide an affordable future for its young people. And that's not happening.
And then
we would see, for example, Owen Brin talking about building huge amounts of council houses, etc. Then we could see whether they put their money where their mouth is. But I fear, and I said this to my son last week, he's now living in Boston, I fear that if that doesn't happen, you know, where is the hope? Where is the hope for Irish people? Because all we've heard, I mean, Simon Harris, for example, since his election, we don't know what he stands for. He's not interested. He has no solutions for the housing problem, you know, for the cost of living crisis. It's all just the same things, you know.
But you know what he does, Joe?
What's going to happen?
He stimulates the Fine Gael erogenous zones.
I saw that. You know, in his biography of Jack Butler Yeats, who, you know, Simon's obviously a Greystones man. In his biography of Jack Butler Yeats, you know, WB's brother, and he moved to Greystones in 1910. Bruce Arnold described Greystones as, quote, a stronghold of Protestantism and Unionism, wealthy, stable, and smug. And as Brian Feeney, you know, I think from an SDLP background, he wrote a very funny piece during the Irish News. He said, you know, safe to assume Simon didn't bump into many Republicans in his formative years. Yet it is interesting, is it not? That at the last general election, Sinn Féin's John Brady was elected on the first count with almost 25% of the vote to Simon's sort of 12%. So, I mean, there are things happening out there.
That's because Sinn Féin didn't run enough candidates, just to point out.
But I wonder,
PR works.
I know, appreciate that. But I wonder if the media will be able to destroy them. Or whether or not, when it comes to the election, people will say, you know, listen, we're going to have a go at something different. We really actually do need something different.
Well, the balance of powers, if all the polls are to be believed, and I don't think we should spend too much time talking about them, but you know, independence and all, and the new wave of independence is going to have a huge say in it. And I think I do agree with you, Joe, on this. I do think that it's going to be, there is a kind of worrying, because there is definitely an appetite for change and there is definitely a need. Like, I'm not going to vote for Sinn Féin because I can never vote for Sinn Féin.
Because you're too posh.
No, because I
know. You're delightful. You're reassuringly posh.
No, it's to do with nationalism. You know that. You know that, Joe. But at the same time, there are young people, you know, there is definitely a need for change and there is a need. And I actually don't know where I would vote, because it seems it's very hard to look around any of the parties and think, is there anything there that you would actually feel? You know, Rory Hearn is running in Europe and he is an interesting candidate. But the point is that there are young people who feel the really need
to... Owen O'Brien was in school with you.
He was. We're going to have
vote for Owen.
Well, I can't vote for him. He's not in my constituency.
But he's quite posh.
We're going to have him on. We'll talk about our time in school together.
Did he not go to Black Rock? Is he not a Black Rock College boy?
He is, yeah. But I'm not voting on the basis of where...
Are you a Black Rock College boy?
I am, yeah. But I don't...
What do you think the percentage of Black Rock College boys is who vote for Sinn Féin? Would it be less or more than 0.01%?
I'd say it's less than that. I'd say we keep a tight hold on that and keep it down. But we'll have Owen on soon and we can talk about our days in school together. But I do think that there is a worrying development if you see a kind of a doll where there isn't a real mandate for change at the end of this election and it's a fractured a fractured doll with independence and, as you said, a weird collection put together. And
isn't it funny
what that will mean for people who do feel like that they want change, you know?
The most depressing thing about the world, and I mean, I come back to that small, but, you know, very depressing, because I know some of the people who are at it. I'm going to speak to them when I see them, you know, just find out what it was all about and why they were there, you know. But the most depressing thing, as we saw, was Brexit. We saw what happened, you know, at the last general election in the UK, is how easy it is to get people who are struggling in poverty to vote against their own interests just by appealing to these base emotions.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we really need to figure out is how to safeguard people against that. And maybe that means really detailed education at school from a young age in relation to all of this stuff, like they have in Finland, for example, where from the age of 4 or 5, they start educating them about misinformation and how to spot it.
Yeah.
You know, about the fundamentals of life.
Yeah, I think that's right.
We need to get more people listening to Free State.
We do. Well, on that note, next week, I just want to say before we go that we will be dealing in the most profound and beautiful way with the fundamentals of life. Because we are putting out our 2 hours we had with Christy Moore, and we'll put them out next week. It was really magical. It was a privilege to sit with him, and he sang and he spoke and he talked about his life and times. And unfortunately, Joe also sang. But we had to, everyone in the room humored him. But we're putting that out next week. That'll be, out wherever you get your podcasts, as they say, and this one we're very, very privileged and proud of. So thanks everybody for listening this week, and we'll talk to you soon.
God save Ireland, says the hero. God save Ireland, says the young. And the weather on the scaffold high, on the battlefield we die. No matter when for Ireland dear we fall. No matter when for
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.